This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This decade marks the 50th anniversary of many important moments in the civil rights movement. Most recently, people gathered to commemorate the 1965 Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March. And a group of scholars and activists is gathering today, pushing for more dialogue that links the past with the present. They're hosting a public roundtable at the National Humanities Center to pose the question, how does the history of racial violence continue to resonate today? How does it shape our education and our criminal justice system? How does it have an impact on individuals, families, and communities? I'm joined now by three panel participants. Nan Elizabeth Woodruff is a current fellow at the National Humanities Center and the convener of this event and the conference. She's usually based in Pennsylvania, where she's a professor of African American Studies and Modern U.S. History at Penn State. Nan Elizabeth Woodruff, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Diane Freelon Foster, a longtime civil rights activist based in Mississippi. She's currently a field staff worker at the Southern Echo, a leadership development organization in Jackson, Mississippi. Diana, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And with us is Rita Bender, an activist and lawyer who's been working on civil rights issues around the country. Her husband, Michael Schwerner, was one of three men murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in Neshoba County, Mississippi, in June of 1964. Rita now practices law in Seattle, Washington. Rita, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Nan, start by telling us about the premise of this roundtable and the sort of the center of this discussion.
Well, we wanted to bring together some activists and scholars who would talk about the legacies of violence and systemic racism, not just in the contemporary South, but in the country as a whole, and to recognize that violence against people of color in this country has a deep history, that it's at the core of who we are as a country, that we're a country born in violence with slavery and the genocide of Native Americans, and it's something that we might acknowledge in a textbook, factually, but we've never really come to terms with the legacies of that violence as it continues today.
And the legacy, Diana, is that it isn't just a historical fact that we need to come to terms with, but it is something that resides in our social institutions and in the minds and hearts of people who are walking today in the United States.
Yes.
Is that fair to say? Tell us about your experience in Grenada and the desegregation there, which is one of the lesser-told stories in the civil rights movement and yet perhaps one of the most violent desegregation episodes in American history.
Yes to both of those. I was 16 years old when the James Meredith March Against Fear came through the city of Grenada, which is where I lived. That was in June, and then in September, we desegregated the schools, and it was, as you say, one of the most violent desegregations that happened, I would say, in the nation. On the day of on our first day of school, it appeared that there was actually, I say conspiracy, I've been told not to use that word because it's divisive, but I say conspiracy because at about 11 o'clock that morning, we heard the principal over the intercom call out most of the white girls to the office. And when we kind of figured out what was going on, we didn't know exactly, but we knew something was up. And we stood up to walk out. The bell rang. And as we went out of the school, and it was a beautiful school, architecture, really beautiful, really high steps. And as we walked out on the steps, we saw a lot of the girls who had been in the school across at the library. And we saw them and their mothers across the street. And then we saw their fathers, friends, uncles, brothers, or whomever, but basically males in the trees, on the grounds, with axes, with sticks, with chains. And we just knew that we were about to go out into a mob. And we turned to go back into the school. And the principal told us that we could not go back in, that we had to leave the school building. And so we walked out and we did what we were told to do. We walked out into the mob and we were beaten. We attempted to get away. And it was really violent.
How old were you?
I was 16 at the time.
You have said that that at first the girls weren't beaten, but every attempt you made to help those who were hurt led to?
Because in the group that I was in, it was one young man, and the rest of us were females. And I'm told, because I didn't remember the story, my when we started talking about it, my mother had mentioned that I had been hit, but I didn't remember that. And I suppose that I suppressed that because I didn't want to remember it. But my mother told me that I had been hit. And then when Nan talked with another young lady who was in the group, she revealed also that I had been hit when I went back to help the young man. But it was actually several of us. It was, I want to say seven, maybe six, seven girls, and then the one young man. And they were really beating him more than they were us. They were really, you know, screaming, "Niggers, go back. We don't want you at the school. We built a school for you. Why are you here?"
How important was that revelation that you had been, that you had repressed memories of that episode that you were in the center of? How important is that to your activism today?
I think it's important because if I did that individually, then I look at collectively how much we've forgotten and how much we suppress and why we suppress it. And part of why we suppress it is because we don't confront it.
Rita, tell us about the link that you see between historical violence and our present day. Let's talk about the education system just as an example.
Well, as Nan said, this country was founded on terrible violence. We were a slave nation. And only after the Civil War was the Constitution amended to create a concept of national citizenship for all our people. The violence, when I went to school, and I went to school in the North, in the Northeast, we never were taught our history. Mm-hmm. We never were taught the role of Thomas Jefferson and many of the other men who are in the pantheon of heroes of the country. We were never taught that they were both slave owners and that they drafted a constitution to perpetuate slavery. The violence of the 20th century is not talked about. And not only does it mean that people who were the victims of the repression and the violence have, in many cases, repressed what happened to them or at least not publicly talked about it, but it also means that the generations of people who were part of the repression and their children now don't understand that history and don't understand why it has to be talked about.
But Nan, talk about the challenges. You heard Diana say she's been warned not to use conspiracy, even though clearly there was a plan, and a plan is a conspiracy. If you think about the violence, economic growth in this country, both North and South, depended on slave labor and a violence that is inhumane and unconscionable by any standard. Jim Crow cannot be called anything but terrorism to repress an entire population into a state of fear, white and black, about what will happen to you if you dare to think about equality. It's terrorism. It's conspiracy. It is repression of the highest order. And yet we know if we use those terms, it's going to be hard to get a conversation going. That's the truth of the thing. What are the challenges of getting us to acknowledge this past that none of us wants to look at and admit that we've all, well, some of us have benefited by?
I mean, it's enormous to try and get people to talk about this and to confront it because, at least in the South, I think people, white people, are very invested in a certain narrative of history, and they take it very personally. And so when you try to talk about the complicity within communities and within families, it's very difficult. They don't want to confront that. They So I.
But is there a language that we can use? Or let's say we're not going to say conspiracy anymore. We're not going to have terrorism. We won't call it genocide anymore. The attempt to annihilate every Native American on the continent. Okay, we won't call it genocide. Now what? Is there a way to have that conversation with a soft, gentle language that brings people in and
I think I'm going to ask. I'm going to turn to Rita on that because I think she might have had more experience with that or thinking about it.
I don't think we should be soft peddling this history. I think that's been done for too long, and it has given many of us white folks a pass. We have an educational system that has deliberately denied education not just to people of color, but by virtue of not teaching who we are and where we came from and where we need to go. There's been no acceptance of responsibility as a people, as a nation, for the steps that have to be taken to meld us together into something constructive.
And lest we think it's all over, Diana, you became the mayor of Grenada. Tell us about your experience as mayor of Grenada.
Sometimes I think when people ask the question about my experience of mayor, and I'm not saying that you did or do, they assume that it was a position of power, and it was not. It was a symbolic position. And I only ran because I had worked in many other campaigns, and I knew that it was an opportunity for an African-American to win because the city was majority black. And one of the white males made the mistake of not running. So there was only one person running. So I had to show the children when opportunity arises, you take advantage of those. And I asked everybody else to run. I did not want to run. But everyone I talked to said, well, why are you asking us? You're the best candidate. So that was pretty much why I ran. I also understood, though, that it was a position of influence and that there were things that I would be able to do influentially inside of that position. And one of those things that I wanted to do was to bring forth the issues around working with children and families, which I did not think was being done and is still not being done inside of our city and other cities as well. So in that sense, I thought it would be, the more I thought about it, I just knew it would be a great opportunity and that it needed to be done if for virtue of nothing else other than showing our young people that, again, these positions are open to you and you can take advantage of them. I would much rather have been a city council person where the power of the pen was, but that opportunity, this opportunity arose. And so I took advantage of that. But I never had an opportunity to do any of the things that I planned to do because there was a white group that was organized and they termed themselves a group that was working because they didn't have representation. They had been, they had chosen to move outside of the city, even though they were still receiving services, but they had chosen to move outside of the city. And according to them, they were being taxed without representation, but it was really about power inside of the city. So about a year into the position, the Justice Department did not reject their annexation application that they had rejected in the previous years. And so then that gave the district courts an opportunity to order a new election. And so after the new election was ordered, then of course, after the annexation was done, the city was again majority white. And of course I knew I could not win the position again, but I did run so that the city council, so that more African Americans would come to the polls, so that the city councilman would win their seats. But the position itself, I simply was not able to do all that I wanted to do.
They changed some of the parameters, right? Some of the rules about what a mayor could do while you're in office, right?
Not necessarily about a what. I just didn't have the time to do it. It was just not that I didn't have the time.
They suddenly called
the Yeah, because the election was, you know, the seat was taken. I say the seat was taken from me because actually even inside of the new election, and I've talked to several attorneys, but you know, we could not find anyone to actually take the case. But they were saying that really the mayor's seat should have never been part of the new election. I don't understand the legalities of that, but we did look into it, but we just could not find anybody to take the case. But I think for me, after the election, after the second election, I think for me, I became kind of a lot depressed, and the people were depressed because they could not understand what happened. I understood what happened because, I mean, I know, you know, I understand history. They could not understand it. And so it really was really like a really kind of took us back some steps.
We are talking about the lingering effects of racial violence today on The State of Things. Diana Freelon Foster is one of my guests, along with Nan Elizabeth Woodruff and Rita Bender. Rita, we talked a little bit about white privilege, the difficulty of letting go. The fact is, national attention to the voting rights campaign was inflamed, and people paid more attention when your husband, another white man, and a black man were killed, in large part because two white people were killed down there. Now you're a white activist. Is there still a kind of privilege in this movement for white people?
Well, I don't know that it's a privilege in the movement. I think there's certainly a privilege in the country. And I'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who, in honesty, denied that that privilege existed. I think even those people who do not want there to be a change don't want it to be a change because they know they're privileged.
Well, I mean, I wonder because a lot of what you hear in white America is that we as white men are being challenged. We're losing everything. It's not that we have privilege. We're losing our equality. We never had a privilege, and now we're going back. I mean, that's part of the argument, right? That's what you're up against.
So we go back to the fact that if we don't teach our history and if we don't understand what has happened and where we are now. Look, we are a nation right now at a very serious junction. We have the rising of the far right in a way that we haven't seen for many years. We have an absolute resistance to things that should be, of course, kinds of things like dealing with educational equity, dealing with the over-incarceration of black youths, dealing with, I mean, we have a Congress that cannot get their heads wrapped around the idea that everyone in the richest nation in the world should have adequate health care.
Diana, as you think about your experience as mayor of Grenada, which was what year? When did this happen?
2004.
2004. And there's all this talk about being in post-racial America. There's a sense that not only are we not beyond it, that we're going backwards, that instead of all advancing to a post-racial, that we're actually all headed to Mississippi, that we're all becoming Mississippi.
Exactly. I agree.
How do we have this conversation?
How do we have the conversation?
Yeah.
I can't answer that because in my hometown, I'm the racist. I'm the one who has the hostilities because I want to confront history. And that's not only from whites, that's from blacks as well. And that's because that's what not confronting does. We had talked about my time as mayor. During that tenure, I hosted a commemoration services to commemorate the 1966 Freedom Movement. And it was the first time we had tried to do it before, But all of the local offices actually sent funding. But only one official showed up, and that was the circuit clerk. And she stood and apologized because she had gone to school. She had been one of the students in the school, and she stood and apologized. But I really do believe that that was one of the reasons why they did not want me as mayor, is because they did not want this history confronted.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. You can see the details of this conversation at our website, stateofthings.org. There's more to come.